There's a moment of mischief early on in your memoir. You're 10 years old and living in the Carlyle Hotel in New York City. And 20 floors below you, you see a woman painting a table white. And what did you do?
I made a water bomb of ink very quickly. And I opened the window very wide. And with some accuracy, I threw it out the window, shut the window, and ran up a flight of stairs to my room so I couldn't be caught.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Nelt J about North of Crazy, her memoir describing the struggles she faced growing up in the shadow of her family's fortune, and her process of self-discovery and liberation through art. This program contains adult material and may not be suited to all audiences. Do you remember what it looked like? Did you get to
Yes.
see your work?
I can see it now.
Can you describe it?
Yeah, I can. It was a simple, very simple table that she had.
Yeah.
And the bomb hit almost in the dead middle. And it had probably about half a teacup full of ink in it.
Uh-huh.
It was quite a lot. And it just, because I dropped it 20 floors, it went quite far, including all over her.
What color was the ink?
It was absolutely black, and I often thought about it when I was starting doing Sumi ink.
That's right. Can you explain Sumi?
Yes, it's taking a very dark ink, very black ink, which you can either grind yourself, which is meant to be part of the whole experience to give you patience to make the most perfect stroke. But taking a brush and dipping it in the black ink and then just stroking it across rice paper. Now, the rice paper is sitting on felt, white felt, and that absorbs a lot of the ink. But if you don't have it, if you put it on something else, if you put it on wax paper, it'll just blur. But then you have to do a whole business of mounting it on another piece of rice paper, which includes flour, alum, water, and a great deal of patience. And then you have something that you can put in a frame that is fixed, is presentable. If you don't do that, you have a crinkled piece of rice paper, which you can press with an iron, but it never really presses right.
Yeah.
Because the water, the ink absorbs differently.
Uh-huh.
But Sumi ink was like dropping, and I did huge pieces of it and smacked a brush down, and of course it went spraying all over. And that all started with that all started when I was 9 years old. And
that's amazing. Let's get the lineage out of the way so we can just talk about you.
Okay. My dad is Nelson Doubleday. His father was Frank Nelson Doubleday, who started Doubleday McClure, which was the beginning of Doubleday and Company. He had a sister who married a man named Huntington Babcock, and her name was Dorothy. In our family, there was my mother, who was Ellen. She was Ellen McCarter, and she was married to Atwood Violet before and had two girls. And then my brother Nelson was the firstborn. And then I was born about a year and a couple of months later.
Mm-hmm.
And I was born in 1934. So I'm now at the great age of 82.
You talk about the dance of pretend growing up. Do you remember, was there a moment when you said, I'm not doing this anymore?
I never did it. I was very taken with getting my mother settled after my father died. She drank much too much.
Yeah.
And I was going to marry John Sargent. I mean, there was a moment, I mean, this invitation to marriage came at a very odd moment and was addressed in an odd way.
And you were 17, 18?
I was 18.
Yeah.
17, wasn't it? And he wanted me for my money and for my position. I knew that. I wanted away from her.
Out, yeah.
So it was a business deal.
Yeah.
And we grew to love each other in the best ways we could. I, on one level, he on another, and it didn't quite jive. And I always wanted him to be much more loving than he was capable of.
Yeah. When you married John Sargent, and the two of you had two kids together, and one of the things you talk about in the book is your own maternal anxieties about being a mom, given the type of mothering you received.
Well, I never had any mothering.
Right.
And the only mothering I had had was either from maids who were good at it, a cook who was good at it, and Virginia, who was lovely, and an interest from my sister, Pucky.
Yeah.
But I never had it from my mother, so I didn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
And when I had children, I found that very anxiety-making, and I was terrified that I was doing, when I traveled with their father, with John Sargent, I was leaving them, I was abandoning them, they were going to feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, when I went to Selma, the psychiatrist that I was going to, and John was going to, Sergeant was going to as well, called me up the night before and said, you're abandoning your children just like you were abandoned. And that's something that they shouldn't do. And so I left him.
What did it mean to be female in your family?
It was a very male-run household. My mother, there's a passage in there where my mother trains me to be what a woman is meant to be at my time, in my time of life, to marry somebody and how I'm meant to behave.
I flagged it. Will you read it?
Okay. Over time, years really, my mother subtly told me what was expected of a woman, what a man wanted when he married. Learn to be the power behind the throne. Help boost men's egos. And never confront them directly with your desires. Be clever. Take no credit for an idea. Let it always come from him, even if the suggestion was yours. Marrying for love is not always necessary for a happy life. Mind and ambition are more important than the body. It is a woman's job to be the source of interest in a conversation. Bring up ideas about books you have read or something in the newspaper. I suppose sports, if you're pushed to it. And use your charms, darling. With authors, ask them about what they are in the midst of. It's a good phrase. It covers lots of territory without being specific. Or tell them what you enjoyed in their book. Always read the book before meeting the author. Use your charms on everyone, women too, for they're the competition. Think of something of interest that will capture the attention of a dinner partner. And at any party, rescue a man standing off alone by himself. He's usually fearfully shy. Sometimes you do get a grouch who wants to be left alone, but rarely. And be kind to a lonely-looking woman as well. You never know when it might be you.
What advice would you offer women today struggling to find their voice?
It is difficult. And there is a loneliness. And quite often the women who are trying to find their voice have in some way been abused either emotionally in their homes originally or by an early husband or by a boyfriend or by another woman. If your voice matters, it will get there. I mean, mine I found in paint. It took me a long time to get there. It took a lot of work over many, many years. And it still does. I mean, it's still filled with anxiety. I look at a canvas and I go, ooh! Yeah. And, but that's all part of it.
Mm-hmm. In regards to your art, there are several locations in the book where you write that the landscape fed you.
Oh, it feeds me. Whether it's out the window of the car today, driving, yes, it does very much. And I go to Little Crazy, which is my cabin every weekend, and I look out at the land, and I take walks by the creek, and I climb up the hills, and they're hills I've climbed up time and time again. But each time I see a new stone, I see a yucca, I see footprints of deer, elk, occasionally mountain lion. I'm part of that world, and I become part of that world. Mm-hmm. And when I get back to my house on Piney, which is, it's where everything from my painting life and my ranching life and my just regular sort of kid's life with my family and then the store mm-hmm. all take place. Mm-hmm. And so that's, and I've been busy fixing gardens this year, so.
What are you going to grow?
Well, I grow all sorts of things depending on where. I grow a lot of annuals. Uh-huh. I have a greenhouse. And I've been buying a lot of perennials because I'm trying to get stabilized in various places. And it's like doing a painting because I start and it looks perfectly well now. Mm-hmm. Most people would say it's done.
Yeah.
But I can't bear to keep my fingers off it.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't bear not to add, you know, some tall leaves here or some forget-me-nots there or some vines there or we need an arch here or we need. It's creating an environment of closeness, of safety,
yeah,
and of adoration of color.
And layers.
Layers.
You use layers in your work.
Yeah, and in painting I do many, many layers because I got hooked very early on the swamps in South Carolina. That's really true.
You have to say more then.
Well, in the swamps, there were trees that are dead and there are all their sort of vague branches. And in South Carolina, there was a lot of moss hanging down, Spanish moss. And the water is very black. So when looking in, even when the sun is shining on it, there are layers of trees and back that are also dead, layers and layers of them. So you see silver spines, and then you see the moss hanging down, and then you see a broken branch, and then you see the black and the sun touching the water and shimmering the water. And it's like a mirror, and then you see what? So it's wanting always to do this, mm-hmm. to part the curtains.
Yeah.
And get to the back and see the kernel.
Yeah. It reminds me so much of your search for truth in this, in your memoir. It's like always searching for what is the truth, what's the reality here?
Yeah, and I don't know where that came from. except that I lived in a crazy world where they were pretending all the time.
I wanted to ask you about the impulse to write the book.
To write the book?
To write your memoir.
I always wanted to write it, really.
Yeah.
But what I had several things that I wanted to say. I wanted my voice and my truth, because I had always felt that I had no way of getting to that in my childhood and in my young life, and how I have had to fight to be able to say my truth, to be able to even know my truth.
Yeah.
It takes knowing before you can say. The second thing was, I was sexually abused as a child, mm-hmm. At 9 years old, by a friend of the family. And it was totally ignored by my family. And my mother only said to me, don't ever talk to your father about it. It makes him mad. And that was the end of it. And she did mention it shortly before she died. She said, you know, you've had bad luck with 3 men. I said, who's the third? But that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Now, there are millions and millions of women who have had the same thing. I'm not new. And I wanted them to know there was somebody who had been brought up in a household where everything was possible, and that love was little.
Yeah.
And that I had been molested. And just knowing that might give them the courage to talk to somebody. Now, interestingly enough, I have had many people come to me after my readings. Months later, they've written me. And it's worked. And that the fact that I have mentioned it in the book has made it available for others to speak, including men.
This is The Right Question. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Nelt J about her memoir, North of Crazy. She's a Wyoming-based artist and granddaughter of Frank Nelson Doubleday, founder of the famous Doubleday and McClure Publishing Company. This conversation is available online at mtpr.org. Also, check out our podcast and visit our Facebook page.
Now, Jay, who is Peaches?
Ah, Peaches. My first husband, John Sargent, could be a pompous ass. But he came, I was talking to a zoo man who ran a zoo who had just published a book. And my husband was a publisher, and the man's name was, I believe, Saunders or something like that. Anyway, I can see his face, and I can see his fingers. And my husband said, don't talk to her about animals. She's just so emotional about them. And it was a real put down, and it pissed me off.
Yes.
And by this time, I had lived, I think I had one child at home, and I was pregnant with another. Mm-hmm. So I'd had a few years on me of being a wife, and I was maybe 20, 21, 22, because I had my first child when I was 21 and my second when I was 23. So I contracted with this man to get a wallaby, but he didn't have a wallaby. He had a wallaroo. Now, a wallaroo is a little smaller than a wallaby. Uh-huh. And if you want to pick them up, you have to pick them up by the tail and hold them out apart from your body at the parallel.
Uh-huh.
Or they will kick you in the belly, and they really hurt when they kick you in the belly. Now, this little wallaroo that I had weighed 85 pounds, and I couldn't hold it out here.
Right. I love the description of the diet that Peaches had, which was root vegetables, some hamburger, and jelly beans on Sunday.
Yes.
That sounds lovely.
And I went to the delicatessen and said, I have to have jelly beans for my wallaroo on Sunday. And the guy at the delicatessen said, here, and just handed them to me and never said a word about what.
I want to go to another wild experience. You did some traveling in your days, and you met Princess Elizabeth, and you also marched with Martin Luther King.
Yes.
Those are two incredible experiences.
Yes. I mean, if you look at what my life has been, it has had marked events.
Yeah.
In marching with Martin Luther King, it was the first time that I did something with my two feet and my body that my mind and my heart wanted to do.
Yeah.
It was a truth that I had that I put my body in place of. And for that particular reason, it changed my life.
What happened after the march then?
Afterwards, I moved to Wyoming.
Uh-huh.
I married the Englishman I'd been living with for a couple of years, and I was his fourth wife. I knew better. We were married for the brief 7 years. We lived together for longer. But I moved to Wyoming, and in Wyoming, I found... And I can't really put it into more words than saying, but I found my heart's home in a very rudimentary, strong, earth-connected way. I think I live in a Piney Creek Valley. It is a gorgeous valley. And when, many years later, when I wanted to... Actually, it was when I realized I was going to die. It took me till I was 60 to realize I was going to die. And once I realized I was going to die, I looked at that valley and I thought, who will take care of this valley? Who will love this valley? Who will see these trees along the creek, the willows, the box elder trees, the hillsides, the creek? The dancing light. And I thought, I need to find people who will care for it. And my kids can't. I mean, it's more than what they can do and their children can do. So I started an artist residency program. And it has been just a delight because the artists have provided exactly what I wanted. They have a delight. They have time, they have space, and they have a delight in the landscape. And whether they paint it in reality or they paint it in the abstract or they write it in a small scene in a book, it has changed many lives as it has changed mine. And I have felt totally encompassed in safety and joy in that little valley that looks down at the Bighorn Mountains.
I watched a video of you, and one of the quotes you said is, "Yes, my art is sophisticated. It is not wildlife. It is not landscape that can be read as landscape in terms of photographic vision. But my passion is Wyoming passion."
My passion is Wyoming passion. Yeah, absolutely. It has totally captured my heart. And I'm sure that I lived there in another lifetime. That's what I feel.
I'm wondering if you would be willing to read a section about tasting color as you paint.
I taste color sometimes when I'm deeply concentrating in the beginning, middle, or toward the end of a painting. It does not always come to me succinctly. I have to murmur it, caress it, place my brush or rag, I use both, on the glass door palette, poke at the colors laid out before me, let my eye rove over the generous mounds of paint. The sensation, palpably lush, invites my whole being to choose color. The choosing feels so intense. But in the end, the choice is random. I try one, then another hue, thin it down with gel or matte medium, slap the brush on the canvas, let the paint fly, the drips roll. Sometimes I find I have held my breath until I lift my brush off the canvas. I gulp air, return to my palette for more paint, more colors in the dance, wild and wide, sensitive, bold, there, sensuous, everywhere. A dream. Zydeco music beats. Is the painting beginning to work? Maybe, well, maybe. But it needs just a mark, a big one, a purple blended with blue, with which demands has a yellow, a cold yellow, like a lemon, then strong, warm orange next to a cobalt blue. I blend colors on the canvas, using my whole body, my arm out, outstretched and sweeping gestures, now all muscles taut, then the tender lines, or the soft blend of lush alfalfa fields and sun-soaked terracotta, like Moroccan sands.
Tell us about the title of the book, North of Crazy.
North of Crazy is, I have a cabin, actually. It's a house, but it's sorted out as a cabin I was going to just go to occasionally, and I've ended up going there every weekend. It's a place where my soul gets stocked up. Uh-huh. And it's on the little North Fork of Crazy Woman Creek. So it's part that I've been called crazy all my life because I didn't fit. And that's just fine with me.
You seem pretty fine with it now, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty fine with me.
Yeah.
I have a good life now. Mm-hmm. I have a wonderful life. I'm lucky enough to be talented and up as a painter. I feel good about the book. Mm-hmm. And I have met such fun people traveling.
Yeah.
And that makes a huge difference.
Nelce lives in Wyoming. Look for more information about her and her book and subscribe to our podcast at mtpr.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.